Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, a few things. If you haven't yet, check out our series Chinese Prestige. If you are an annual subscriber, you get access to it. Everyone else has to pay $5 for now. I believe we're going to be raising the price soon, so if you haven't purchased it yet, please do. It is at ChinesePrestigePod.com. Again, that's ChinesePrestigePod.com. Again, want to plug our Discord. A lot of good conversations there recently. It's really interesting stuff about international politics, regular politics, also just, you know, fun meme stuff is wont to happen on the internet. So if you haven't checked out our Discord, check that out as well. All right, Derek, let's jump into the news. Let's start with Russia, Ukraine, and let's start with new American diplomacy going nowhere.
Right. Well, the Trump administration introduced a 28-point plan, peace plan, as I'm sure people heard. We may have talked about this the last time we met to do the news, that basically seems to have codified a number of Russian positions. There's been a great deal of pushback against that from the Ukrainians, from the Europeans over the last couple of weeks. That's resulted in some form of revision to the 28-point plan. I don't know what those revisions are. I don't think anybody's made them public or even leaked them to the press, as far as I can tell. So it's unclear what the peace plan that's on the table right now currently looks like. There's been a bit of diplomacy over the last few days around the plan. Marco Rubio had a meeting with Ukrainian representatives in Florida on Sunday. They discussed basically shored up, I guess, some of the Ukrainian concerns ahead of a trip to Russia by Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the Trump administration's envoys on this. Those two spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin without apparently making very much progress. I mean, everybody said it was a productive meeting. The Russians said, you know, it went well, but there's no indication that they found any wiggle room or common ground or compromise from the Russian perspective in terms of the big issues, which are territory and Ukraine's ability to defend itself or its security guarantees or any security guarantees that it would have after the war. There is no indication that they made any progress on any of that. Witkoff and Kushner have headed back to the U.S. They're supposed to be meeting, I think, today. We're recording this on Thursday. I think today with a Ukrainian team to kind of debrief and talk about where things stand. But as far as I can tell, they don't really stand anywhere that they didn't stand a couple of weeks ago. And the fundamental issues remain Russia's demand that Ukraine give up territory in the Donbas that Russia currently doesn't have, and the demands that the Ukrainians not join NATO, that they codified in their constitution, the Ukrainian constitution, that they will never join NATO, that there are limits on the Ukrainian military, and you know, a ban on foreign troops, at least European or U.S. troops or military forces being stationed inside Ukraine. I've seen some analysis of this that sort of resonated with me. The essential issue when you get past these individual things is Vladimir Putin still doesn't regard Ukraine as a sovereign nation. And as long as that's the case, there's probably not much room to discuss anything more than a temporary cessation in hostilities. And I think from the Ukrainian perspective, that's the issue. It's not so much giving up the territory or, you know, what that means, although that would be politically very painful and difficult. The bigger issue, I think, is that you're giving up territory for what would probably, under the conditions that have been laid out, be only a temporary respite from conflict before the Russians decide to you know, restart things without some kind of security guarantee. And that's part of, you know, what this discussion has been. It's hard to imagine the Ukrainians, as dire as things are, and as much as this war really needs to end, or you know, the Ukrainian nation is going to suffer a lost generation. It's going to be, you know, the impacts, the further this goes, are just going to get worse and worse, which has been the Trump administration's argument throughout this, as they're negotiating with the Ukrainians. Like, it may not be the best deal, but it's better than what you're going to get 6 months from now, basically, or a year from now. It's really going nowhere. The two sides are pretty intransigent at this point. You know, there's probably a way that you could bridge some of these gaps, but I don't see much indication of flexibility to do that at this point.
So it seems that Ukraine might also be attacking Russian commercial ships. What do we know about that?
Yeah, this has been a recent development over the last week or so, really intensely. The Ukrainians have been using maritime drones, they're called Sea Babies, to attack Russian commercial ships or ships that are connected to the so-called shadow fleet that allows Russia to dodge Western sanctions to some degree, to send export oil and, you know, trade in things that have otherwise been capped or limited by Western action. They've hit two of those ships, two ships that are allegedly connected to the Shadow Fleet, in the Black Sea late last week. There's been a third ship in the Black Sea that has since suffered a similar attack, although I don't think the Ukrainians have claimed responsibility for that one. They did claim responsibility for the first two. There's even been a ship connected, I believe, with the Shadow Fleet, or at least a vessel, a cargo vessel that had left Russia that came under some kind of attack. It seems like there were a number of explosions around it off the coast of Senegal last week. So this may be wider ranging than just the Black Sea. But this seems to be a new, fairly new development on the Ukrainians' part. It's raised a lot of concerns among countries in the Black Sea. The Turkish government has been particularly irritated about this. Not quite as irritated as the Russians, of course, but pretty irritated. Both of the initial attacks, the initial Black Sea attacks, took place in Turkey's kind of maritime economic zone. So they've condemned the attacks. They've raised concerns with NATO officials. You know, they've summoned, I think, the Ukrainian ambassador. They did that on Thursday in Ankara to discuss the issue, shall we say. So there's a lot of kerfuffle about this. It's part of the Ukrainians, I think, strategy of trying to pick at the Russians where they may be vulnerable in terms of energy infrastructure or, you know, economic outlets. This has involved drone strikes on oil refineries and, you know, other facilities like that inside Russia, and now appears to be expanding to the open sea, I guess.
The open sea is going to be at war. All right. Let's talk about the European Union, which is in the process of phasing out Russian natural gas. Very different from what we were thinking was going on 10 years ago.
Yeah. I don't know how far this is going to get, because the EU announced this week that it is going to phase out imports of Russian natural gas by basically the end of 2027. The plan calls for phasing it out by the end of September 2027, but if they can't quite make that deadline, it sets a backup deadline of November 1st, 2027. These are way too far in the future to actually be of much use to Ukraine, I would think, although I guess that conflict could still be going on in 2027, in which case this would be an economic blow to Russia, although the Russians will have time to find other customers as this goes on. The reason that I'm a little skeptical about this is it was adopted in a using a mechanism that allows the EU member states to adopt a policy without full consensus, with only a majority of member states in support. And there are several and a growing number of EU member states that are not interested in participating in an embargo on Russian natural gas, Hungary being the most prominent of those. Slovakia also, I would think, would not be terribly thrilled about being part of this. The Hungarian government has already said it's going to take the EU to court, essentially, to challenge this decision. So we'll see if it actually winds up being a Europe-wide ban on Russian natural gas. But yes, it's a potentially big development, even if just the big heavyweights in the EU, Germany in particular, follow through with this and stick to it. They will have to find other sources of natural gas. This will be good news for the Qataris, probably. It'll be good news for U.S. liquefied natural gas producers. It'll mean probably higher energy costs for people in Europe. But, you know, that's a small price to pay for, I guess, you know, making Donald Trump happy and U.S. Energy companies happy. Again, we'll see if it actually comes to pass. This is a long time in the future, and you know, I don't think it's going to be universally received well in the EU.
I don't think so either. Let's turn to the DRC and Rwanda, and let's talk about this peace deal signing that Trump is hosting.
Yes, Trump is hosting the presidents of those countries, Paul Kagame from Rwanda and Felix Tshisekedi from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Washington today, actually Thursday. Again, we're recording this on Thursday, at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the newly renamed Donald Trump U.S. Institute of Peace, I might add, in a wonderful commemoration of his whatever it is that he's doing around the world. Just a great way for him to commemorate himself and honor himself. We love it. So yes, he's hosting them for a signing ceremony of a peace deal that expands on the one that they agreed to, that the two countries agreed to with U.S. mediation earlier this year, that the foreign ministers signed. It also will codify or further codify something called the Regional Economic Integration Framework, which the two countries agreed to again with U.S. mediation a few weeks ago. So it's expanded beyond the initial peace deal, which still isn't really being implemented, by the way. So that's a concern. Another concern is that as this is happening, as Trump has been making plans to host these guys for this treaty ceremony, the ceasefire in the eastern DRC between the Congolese military and the Rwanda-backed M23 militant group appears to be collapsing. There is new fighting in South Kivu province in particular, pretty heavy, it sounds like. There are reports of, you know, massive deployments of forces, especially on the part of M23. fighting in several towns. So M23 controls much of South Kyiv, conquered it earlier this year. It's unclear to me what started this new round of fighting. Both sides are, you know, as you would expect, accusing the other of having perpetrated it. But things are not looking terribly good right now on the ground in terms of the conflict, the open conflict that this Rwanda DRC peace process is supposed to help resolve. We'll see if that's, I assume it's not going to affect Thursday's signing ceremony, but we'll see what it means for, you know, actually getting any of this stuff off the ground. And of course, Trump is very interested in exploiting the Congolese mineral resources and sort of tapping into that and all the economic things that might resolve. He really is. He really is. And, you know, none of that can happen. Like the immediate thing that has to happen is this M23 conflict has to end. And so if that's flaring up again, that would seem to set everything back to square one, but we'll see.
All right, Derek, let's talk about this new fighting in southern Yemen.
This is potentially significant. I don't know how heavy it's been yet, but the New York Times reported earlier this week, I believe on Wednesday, that fighters from the Southern Transitional Council had moved into Hadramut province, which is in sort of southern, technically southern Yemen. It's more eastern Yemen, but the division there is north and south. The northern part is controlled by the Houthi movement. The southern part is controlled by the, I guess, in a fanciful sense, the nominal Yemeni government that's recognized by the international community and is basically an appendage of Saudi Arabia at this point. The Southern Transitional Council is nominally on the side of that government, of the Yemeni government in the conflict with the Houthis. But their ultimate goal, its ultimate goal as an organization, is to resurrect an independent South Yemen. So it's fundamentally at odds with the Yemeni government in that regard. And, you know, there have been clashes in the past between strictly government forces and STC forces in various parts of southern Yemen. But this seems different. It's more concerted. It seems more intense. They have moved into the province, which is Yemen's really most kind of oil-rich region. They're reportedly fighting over the oil fields to secure control of the oil fields. The STC claims that it's just trying to stabilize the area, that this has become a region that's rife with smuggling, you know, weapons trafficking, you know, a bunch of criminal organizations operating here. So the STC says it's just trying to kind of restore order. That seems a bit self-serving, but who knows, really, I guess. The other thing to consider here is the STC is backed heavily by the United Arab Emirates. And as I said, the government, the nominal government is basically an office in Riyadh at this point. Like they're wholly dependent on Saudi Arabia. So part of the breakdown here in relations between these two groups could be related to the overall rivalry that keeps kind of growing between the Emiratis and the Saudis. So that's another factor to consider here. But this could be pretty significant. It could reopen a civil war in Yemen, not the one that everybody's familiar with at this point between the Houthis and the government, but it could open a new civil war, a new front of the civil war between these southern separatists and the government if it continues like this.
Let's move on to Lebanon, where Israel and Lebanon have held ceasefire talks, even though the IDF attacked Lebanon again.
Right. They held a new round of ceasefire talks on Wednesday. And what was interesting about this is it involved civilian officials from both governments. Civilian Lebanese and Israeli civilian officials have not sat directly around a table with each other and negotiated anything since 1991, when the first Bush administration brought everybody together at what was known as the Madrid Conference to discuss Middle East peace. Suffice to say, they didn't achieve it. So this is a pretty significant development. It maybe comes out of a little bit of pressure from the U.S. On the Israelis. There are reports that the administration had sent its Lebanon envoy, sort of semi-envoy, Morgan Ortegas, to Israel the day before this these ceasefire talks took place. And there have been reports, I think, based on Israeli media reports, that this is interpreted as a bit of pushback against the Israelis, who have been ramping up to what everybody is expecting to be a new, more intense campaign. I don't want to say a new conflict, because they've never stopped bombing Lebanon despite the ceasefire that was reached last November. But a more intense campaign to take out Hezbollah sites, to, you know, ostensibly at least, take out Hezbollah sites. They killed a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut several days ago. That was the first Israeli strike on Beirut in months, I believe. So things have been ramping up, and there was an expectation that a major escalation was in the works. There had been a 3-day halt in Israeli attacks earlier this week because Pope Leo was visiting Lebanon. So they decided to pause rather than continue things with that kind of microscope on Lebanon. And they've resumed again since the ceasefire talks. So who knows, you know, how much progress was actually made here. I do know the Israelis have attacked Lebanon, southern Lebanon, again on Thursday. So despite the momentous occasion here with the civilians negotiating with each other, nothing seems to have changed. It's possible that they've forestalled whatever escalation the Israelis were cooking up. But, only time will tell on that front.
Thanks, Derek. Let's stay in the region. Let's move on to Gaza. And let's start with these new clashes in which a gang leader has been killed.
Right. There's been clashes between Hamas fighters and the IDF that have taken place with some regularity. And these involve Hamas fighters who have been this group of Hamas fighters who have been trapped in tunnels on the Israeli side of the so-called Yellow Line for several weeks. There have been periodic clashes as groups of these fighters have emerged from the tunnels and, you know, run into IDF units, personnel, and engaged in firefights. There was one late Wednesday, or there's one on Wednesday, in which 5 Israeli soldiers were wounded in the Rafah area in southern Gaza, after which the IDF bombarded Gaza. They attacked the tent city in Mawasi and killed a number of Palestinians in retaliation. There's still negotiations, or still, you know, some effort to try and work out a deal where these fighters could be given safe passage. They'd have to give up their weapons, but could be given safe passage out of this Israeli-controlled part of Gaza into the area controlled now again by Hamas. But the Israelis have more or less refused to engage in this. They say they've killed 40 Hamas fighters in these tunnels or around these tunnels over the past several weeks. There's no clarity on how many fighters were trapped to begin with, so it's hard to say how many are left. The Israelis claim it was upwards of 200 Hamas fighters were trapped when the ceasefire went into effect, were trapped in these tunnels. Hamas has given a lower figure of 80 to 100, I believe. So, you know, if the Israelis are correct that they've killed 40 of them, that's it's hard to know how big a chunk that is, but it's certainly a fairly sizable proportion of those fighters, I guess, have been killed. As you said, there is also a report, this was on Thursday, that Yasser Abu Shabab, who's a tribal leader in Gaza, who's been clashing, his fighters have been battling with Hamas. They've been accused of, they have worked with the Israeli government. They are supported by the Israeli government. They've been accused of doing things like looting aid trucks and carrying out, you know, sort of atrocities like that on behalf of the Israelis. He was killed I don't have details really on this. Israeli media reported it on Thursday that he's been killed. I assume he was killed in Rafah because his group is kind of sheltering in the Israeli controlled part of Gaza in Rafah. So I assume it happened there, but the details in terms of how it came about, I don't have, and I don't think the Israeli media has gotten into that. But this is an interesting development. I mean, you know, Abu Shabaab was not in any danger of winning any popularity contests in Gaza or becoming a main political player, but Benjamin Netanyahu has talked about using these factions like his, and there are others that have worked with the Israelis in the past that are opposed to Hamas, using them as the basis to form a temporary administration, a temporary Palestinian administration in Gaza, because he's, of course, opposed to the Palestinian Authority coming in any capacity. So he's, you know, proposed turning to these groups. But, you know, if their leaders are being picked off, then that would obviously frustrate those plans.
Let's talk about the quote unquote progress made on the ceasefire implementation.
It hasn't been much. The two sticking points right now are the Israeli government is refusing to move forward really with any meaningful shift to what is regarded or what is called the second phase of the of Donald Trump's ceasefire framework until all of the bodies of the remaining Gaza captives have been repatriated to Israel. There is progress on that front. There was a body that Hamas repatriated on Wednesday that turns out to have been the body of one of the two remaining captives who still have not been, who had previously not been accounted. That leaves one body obviously left. The searching has slowed down. You know, the longer this goes on and the more, you know, body remains have been repatriated to Israel, it's been harder and harder to find the remaining few. And now there's one left, and the Israelis have suggested that they'll be more open. I don't know what that means, but they'll be more open to kind of advancing the ceasefire process once they get that last body back. You know, I don't know how long that's going to take. And the other big obstacle here is there's just no international support for this stabilization force that the Trump plan envisions, you know, coming in and securing Gaza, because there's still no clarity on what it would be required to do. Is it going to be required to, like, battle Hamas fighters in the streets? Because very few countries would be interested in contributing soldiers to something like that. You know, it's not even clear to me where it's going to be operating. Like, there's some talk that it would operate in the Israeli side of Gaza, the part that the IDF still occupies, or, you know, versus operating in the area that is now effectively back under Hamas's control. It's all still very unclear. And so no government, there's been no indication still from any Arab government, certainly, that they would be willing to participate. Countries like Indonesia and Azerbaijan, which had previously talked about contributing soldiers to the effort, have backed down from that. You know, the Indonesians have now talked about sending basically support personnel. I think Azerbaijan has maybe backed away from their commitment completely, all because this is just still so undefined that countries aren't willing to take the risk.
Israel is also reopening the Rafah checkpoint. Tell us what's going on there, Derek.
The Israeli government announced on Wednesday that it would reopen the Rafah checkpoint, which it's supposed to do under the terms of the ceasefire, I believe, but it's only doing it in one direction, which is to allow Palestinians in Gaza to leave through Rafah and enter Egypt. That means, you know, no aid coming through in the other direction, no Palestinians re-entering Gaza from Egypt going in the other direction. And those terms may not be acceptable to the Egyptians. As I say, the Israelis announced this on Wednesday. The Egyptian government has been not terribly effusive in its response to that that announcement. So I don't know what they're planning to do, but they have rejected in the past the idea of just opening Rafah in one direction. They want it open in both ways. It could be a major development if the Egyptians allow Palestinians to enter Egypt, to leave Gaza and enter Egypt through this checkpoint. It could be a significant development because this has been the main route for medical evacuations out of Gaza. So people who are sick, people who are badly wounded, need medical treatment, obviously aren't going to get it in Gaza, can get out, can get into Egypt and then seek medical treatment from there. So that would be significant. But again, I don't know if Egypt is going to be willing to play ball under these conditions. There is, go back to the issue of the repatriation of all of the remains of the deceased Gaza captives, the Israelis have suggested that they would be willing to consider opening Rafah completely in both directions once again they get back the last body of the last remaining captive who hasn't whose remains haven't been repatriated yet. But who knows if they'll actually stick to that, but that could be a consideration.
Let's move on to Sudan, and let's talk about the RSF, which has claimed a new advance in the Kordofan region.
Yes, the RSF on Monday claimed to have taken a town called Baba Nusa in West Kordofan State, which is a strategically significant town. It's located basically on the route that one would have to take to get from kind of central Sudan, the Khartoum region, the capital area, to the Darfur region, which is almost entirely under Rapid Support Forces control at this point. So if the military were planning to mount an offensive through Kordofan to get into Darfur, they would have to go through Baba Nusa, or likely have to stage it out of Baba Nusa to some degree. So its capture, if the RSF actually has captured it, is a major development. I say if, because the military then pushed back, Sudanese armed forces pushed back after that announcement. I pushed back on Tuesday and said, we're still in control of the town. This is the RSF is lying. There was video that the RSF released on Monday purportedly showing their fighters in control of several parts of the town, including the army base. That still seems to be the case. There is, it does seem that the military has not entirely abandoned Baba Nusa or retreated from Baba Nusa. It's still putting up a fight, but big chunks of the town do seem to be under RSF control, at least as far as anybody's been able to piece together from these videos. Obviously, any news that comes out of Sudan is pretty scant at this point. So, especially from Kordofan, which has become really the epicenter of the conflict now that the RSF has consolidated most of Darfur.
Let's talk about this really strange story in Guinea-Bissau about a coup that may have been staged. What's going on there?
This is fascinating. Yes. So Guinea-Bissau had a general election, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. Both of the main presidential contenders, the incumbent Umaru Sissoco Embalo and Fernando Diaz, the opposition candidate, claimed victory in the early days, a couple of days after the election, as the votes were being counted. The plan was to announce the results, I believe, last Thursday. But the Guinea-Bissau military decided to take matters into its own hands and launched a coup on Wednesday that overthrew Embalo and put both he and Diaz, took both he and Diaz into custody. Embalo has since been allowed to leave the country. He first briefly went to Senegal. He's now in Republic of the Congo in Brazzaville. Diaz, I believe, is still holed up in the Nigerian embassy in Bissau. He's been granted asylum by the Nigerian government, but I don't think they've been able to get him out of the country yet. As you say, there's a lot of speculation here that this was a fictional coup, essentially, that Embalo faked it and put the military in charge to avoid losing the election. Maybe he knew that Diaz had won, or just to kind of he's been under a lot of controversy for sort of unilaterally extending his term and kind of delaying elections. There was major questions about his legitimacy. He has claimed that there have been coup attempts against him in the past. That's partly fueling actually the speculation that he's engineered this, because he's been accused of faking those coup attempts just to sort of drum up popular support or to give himself some credibility. But it's possible, I guess, or under this theory, which has been advanced by a number of officials, like, you know, kind of prominent people in West Africa, the Prime Minister of Senegal, Ousmane Sonko, the former president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, who was in Guinea-Bissau to as part of an observer mission, election observer mission, have sort of joined this train of people accusing Balu. Guinea-Bissau's political opposition led this charge, but it's been picked up by a number of prominent regional figures that he basically engineered this so that he could govern by proxy through the military, and then eventually one assumes he would be, you know, make a triumphant return to Guinea-Bissau at some point. This all seems a little bit far-fetched to me. It's a big risk for somebody to take in his position. But there have been other things about the coup and the aftermath of the coup that seem peculiar. For one thing, Ebalu announced his own ouster. Like, he announced his own coup. He basically called a French media outlet and said, I'm being overthrown. And he was given like media opportunities after that, which is a little strange for a military junta that's just taken power to allow the ex-president or the supposed ex-president to talk to the media. So that was a little strange. The government that the junta has since unveiled, and it's technically under the general, the sort of chief of staff of the Guinea-Bissau military, a man named Horta Inta'a. The government that he's rolled out is full, apparently, of Ebalu loyalists, or at least people who are in Ebalu's political circles. So that seems a little bit fishy. It's also possible, I think, here that the faction that Ebalu represented as president just decided to toss him overboard and throw their lot in with the military so that they could hang on to power, you know, whatever happened to him. But who knows? It's another thing. You know, it's fun to speculate, I guess, or interesting to speculate about. But nobody has any real answers here. All we know at this point is that the military is in control. Ebalu is in Brazzaville. Diaz, as I say, is holed up, I think, still in the Nigerian embassy. They've talked about a one-year transition back to civilian rule. I know the Economic Community of West African States has already sent a delegation to Bissau to discuss the transition with the junta. That's as far as I've gotten with that. The ECOWAS, given its past kind of involvements in trying to navigate coups in the region, would probably be comfortable with a one-year transition if it actually stuck. So I don't think they would push back too hard against that. But, you know, much is still unknown here.
Much is still unknown. A wild story.
I should also say, like, Guinea-Bissau has a history, an extensive history of military coups. There have been four, I think, successful coups at this point. Maybe I don't know if that might have been before when last week. This might be the fifth one. But, you know, there've been a number of attempts. It's a narco state. It's become the major hub for Latin American cocaine heading into Europe. So, I mean, there's a lot of instability, a lot of corruption, a lot of military involvement in corruption that could speak to just a general, you know, kind of a strictly speaking military coup the way that you would expect. But, you know, the speculation that Ebalu is pulling the strings here has not gone away yet.
So, Derek, Trump is a gooner. He has been edging us in terms of military action in Venezuela. So it appears that he is getting closer to actually taking action. So what has been going on? What do we know?
I would say when he hopped on social media on Saturday and announced that Venezuelan airspace should be regarded as closed in its entirety, that was a fairly obvious threat to begin military action, at least airstrikes against Venezuela. There was an expectation that military action was imminent. Trump himself last week told reporters that he was close to announcing a an expansion of his war on speedboats in the Caribbean to land targets, which would obviously be in Venezuela, since we've decided that Venezuela is the hub of all drug trafficking in the world. So, you know, all of that added up to a sense that things were somewhat imminent. Now, that's dissipated a bit since Saturday, given that nothing has happened yet. He hasn't ordered any airstrikes. But also the Trump administration apparently asked the Venezuelan government to start receiving repatriation flights from the U.S. again. Like, it's one of the first things that the Venezuelan government did when Trump closed the airspace, to say, okay, well, we can't take any of your repatriation flights anymore because you've closed our airspace. So they did ask the Venezuelans to reopen airspace for those flights, which maybe suggests that they're not, things aren't quite as imminent as Trump's comments suggested. But, you know, the administration may just not care. It just wants to get these people out of the United States. There was also a report that in the New York Times that Trump acknowledged over the weekend that he had had a phone call with Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, earlier this month. The Miami Herald, among other outlets, later reported on details of that call. It sounds like it was not terribly diplomatic. Like, Trump basically presented Maduro with an ultimatum that he could leave now, and he and his wife and his son would be allowed to leave the country and given safe passage to wherever they wanted to go. But he had to do it right away. There was not going to be any decent interval or any requests for amnesty, which is one of the things that Maduro wants. Reportedly asked for. He also reportedly asked for assurances that his people would be allowed to remain in senior positions in the Venezuelan military, which would potentially undermine a government, whatever government would follow him, if any government at all would follow him. That would make things more difficult for that administration. That was not something that Trump agreed to either. And so, you know, they seem to have been at cross purposes. Maduro clearly hasn't left. So he was not on board with the ultimatum. And that's where things stand. So I still expect airstrikes to be forthcoming. But, I've been wrong about these things before.
Let's talk about the Honduras election.
Yes. This is another you couldn't make this shit up. So Trump, again, over the weekend, hopped on social media to make a big statement in favor of one of the three main candidates in Honduras's presidential election, the former mayor of Tegucigalpa, Nasri Asfura. He threw his support behind him. He was running against the other two major candidates, Salvador Nasrallah, who's sort of a perennial presidential candidate, and the defense minister of the current Honduran government and the nominee of the leftist Libre party, Richie Moncada. It's turned out to not go the way that Trump was hoping, in as much as Asfura is now losing. There was, in the initial kind of preliminary count, had Asfura about 500 votes ahead of Nasrallah. Moncada is way back. She's not a factor in this at this point. But as the counting continued, and there have been a couple of interruptions in the count, which have raised or fueled speculation that some kind of something fishy is going on here, or accusations, I should say, fueled accusations from the Trump administration in particular, that Honduran officials are trying to steal the vote. Nasrallah's lead has now edged into the thousands. He kind of, you know, as the counting went on, he moved past Asfura and is now, I think at last count I saw, was about 14,000 votes ahead of Asfura. But again, there have been some interruptions here. The full results aren't available yet. And Trump is not taking it well. Neither is anybody in his administration. He took to social media again as the counting was going on and as Asfura's lead was disappearing, accusing Honduran officials of trying to change the results of the election and threatening that there would be hell to pay if they stole it from his precious favorite candidate. What ties a bow on this in a sort of perfect way is Asfura is the nominee of the right-wing National Party, and the most recent former National Party president of Honduras is a man named Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had been serving a 45-year prison sentence in the United States for trafficking tons of cocaine into the U.S. But Donald Trump, the man who is going to go to war with Venezuela over drugs, who is murdering boaters in the Caribbean by double digit numbers at this point, 80 some murders since he started this campaign because of drugs, pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, an actual convicted drug trafficker, and he's now free. He claimed that this was a political prosecution by the Biden administration, even though the investigation into Hernandez began during Trump's first term as president. It's all just sort of a wonderful tapestry here, I think, in the commitment to the war on drugs from Donald Trump.
It's really inspirational. Let's talk about the United States pausing entry from 19 countries after the shooting by an Afghan national, or formerly Afghan national, I don't actually know, in Washington, D.C.
The Afghan, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, I believe is his name, was a veteran of a CIA-backed zero-unit kill squad in Afghanistan. He was recruited into it during the U.S. occupation. He was brought to the United States in 2021 after the U.S. withdrew before the Taliban took over, or as the U.S. was withdrawing, I guess. Is the suspect in the shooting of two D.C. National Guardsmen or National Guard personnel. They were West Virginia National Guard personnel, I should say, but they were killed in D.C. They were part of Trump's military occupation of D.C. One of them has died. The other one is still in serious condition. And so in response, Trump announced a number of things, that he was terminating all, immigration from Afghanistan, that he was going to review the status of all Afghan nationals who have been brought into the U.S. But the most tangible thing so far has been that the administration is suspending immigration from 19 countries. These are 19 countries that were highlighted all the way back in June when Donald Trump issued an executive order restricting immigration from them. They include Afghanistan, also Burundi, Chad, the Republic of the Congo, Cuba, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Laos, Libya, Myanmar, Sierra Leone, Somalia, Sudan, Togo, Turkmenistan, Venezuela, and Yemen. So it's halted basically immigration from all of those. I think there is some push to review the status even of green card holders from those countries. So we'll see what the further ramifications of this are.
And let's end on this double tap strike on a boat off the coast of Venezuela that has raised new legal questions. And to me, Derek, I don't know what you think, seems to have led a lot of MAGA people to scramble a little bit.
I think there's this is shaking people up a little bit. And it's been interesting to watch kind of everybody dive for their own foxhole and abandon everybody else in the heat of the moment. But the Washington Post reported that during a September 2nd strike on one of these alleged drug boats in the Caribbean, this was, I believe, the first one of these that they carried out, that Pete Hegseth, the Fox and Friends host turned defense secretary, turned pretend secretary of war, basically gave what they called a spoken directive to kill everybody on that boat. The initial strike left two survivors, apparently. They could see this on satellite imagery, two people clinging to sort of the wreckage, what was left of the boat. And at that point, the special operations commander who was overseeing the strike, Frank Bradley, who was at the time the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command in the U.S. military, gave the order to strike again, killing these two people in what was assuredly a war crime. Even, if you argue that the initial strike was legal, which I think is a long shot, striking it again to kill two people who were clinging to wreckage in the waters of the Caribbean, who were no threat at all to the United States, even under the dubious standard that would have been offered to argue that the initial strike was dealing with a threat to the United States. This was just murder. I mean, this was just killing people who were helpless, no threat. And, you know, as you say, it has this story has caused some shockwaves, even within the Trump administration. It's even caused some Republicans in Congress to question the legality of it, to question the legality of the boat strikes in general. The administration has, in classic fashion, thrown Bradley under the bus. Both the White House and Hegseth, after this story came out, basically said Bradley gave the order. We didn't have anything to do with it. Hegseth even said he left the room after the initial strike because he had things to do. He wasn't there. But he fully supports Bradley, but he didn't have anything to do with it. So if you're going to prosecute anybody, please prosecute prosecute Bradley, not Pete Hegseth. But of course, you know, he supports it. He thinks he did the right thing. He just wants to be clear that it was not Pete Hegseth's fault that this happened. So, yeah, it's been there's been this kind of rush to pin the blame on the military officer and not. And absolve the civilian chain of command from any responsibility. Supposedly, I've seen this just in the last couple of hours before we recorded, that the administration has been showing video of the strike to members of Congress, and some of them are coming away saying this was a very disturbing thing to watch. I don't know any more than that. I don't think there's going to be any prosecutions here because I'm old enough to have lived through the war on terror and all of the things that happened during that. And I don't see anybody really getting into legal jeopardy, but they should be, needless to say, because again, this is just straight murder at this point. There's no reason to sugarcoat it.
Well, grim stuff, as always. Everyone, thank you very much for listening. I don't know why I stumbled on listening there, but thank you very much for listening. Check out ChinesePrestigePod.com, join the Discord, sign up for all of our fantastic bonus episodes. We got a really good one this weekend as well. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.